Hello there. Mary Wilson asked a question on Drive Time on Wednesday evening that was shocking, but given the week that's in it, perfectly obvious.
Do you think they would kill you?
Mary was talking to Tony Lunny from Quinn Industrial Holdings in a week where a stream of stories from the border area made it sound like an abandoned frontier, ideal for lawlessness.
A Garda station in County Monaghan has been extensively damaged by fire. Emmyvale Garda station was closed and no Gardaí were in the building at the time.
The directors of Quinn Industrial Holdings have received a death threat, which claims to be their final warning.
We know that there's a number of posters as part of this campaign of intimidation, and staff at Cavan County Council have been told in this letter that if they try to remove those posters, they will be targeted.
British police investigating the deaths of 39 people who were found dead in a lorry near London last week have named two suspects they want to speak to on suspicion of manslaughter and human trafficking.
On their official website, Essex police have posted images of the brothers. They're known in the Middletown area of County Armagh and in nearby T. Holland, County Monaghan.
Sinn Féin has said that one of its TDs, Martin Kenny, has been the subject of an apparent arson attack at his home in County Leitrim. During a debate in the Dáil this week, Deputy Kenny expressed fears for his safety after speaking about attitudes in society towards migrants.
The Garda Commissioner, Drew Harris, has said he felt confident with the progress that was being made in investigations of recent violent incidents in the border region. He said he did not accept that the area was lawless.
And back to Mary Wilson's interview with Tony Lunny of Quinn Industrial Holdings. He's the brother of Kevin Lunny, who was abducted, tortured and left for dead by a group who want Sean Quinn back in charge of his old companies. Tony Lunny says his brother Kevin returned to work the other day.
He spent most of an hour up to his office, and we have two large buildings here for at head office for the directors and the senior management, and then we have a drink where we have the services like accounts and HR. And so he went over to both, and he got a great welcome back.
Others of your fellow directors have been targeted, abused, intimidated. It could be any one of you at any time.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a whole new movement, these people that wants to bully and intimidate people. I mean, it seems to be spreading from what we know with Martin Kenny TD's car. And
He thought of you when he saw his car in a fireball on Monday morning.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, social media is not helping this. It's so easy to communicate, and if you want, it's very powerful media, and obviously it has a lot of good, but for people that want to use it for the wrong purposes, it's very, very dangerous. Mm-hmm.
Tony Lunny from Quinn Industrial Holdings with Mary Wilson. Earlier in the week, she spoke with Martin Kenny TD, whose car had been burned out, and he echoed Tony Lunny's thoughts.
One of the days last week was a text message, you know, that I was a coward and a traitor, and that how dare I bring or attempt to bring foreigners into the country, and the country was going to be overrun, and all that sort of the replantation of Ireland, and, you know, traitors should be executed. And asking for me to reply, that type of thing. And then there was another one from the same phone number a couple of days later of a similar vein, except then the other one said, it may be okay for you to be a traitor, or it's your choice to be a traitor, but what about your four children? So obviously this person knew I had four children, whoever is sending it. You know, and there's also a whole lot of stuff online and all sorts of things, you know, and really it's to me, you know, that's the extreme end of it. But there's another part of it, Mary, which has become more acceptable, that, you know, that it's acceptable for people to be unreasonable and to be irrational. And it's almost in some cases a virtue. And I don't think it is. I think we have a responsibility as a society to work down the road to reason and the path to reason, and that's where these things should be going. And that we should be trying to find solutions. But if people come forward with solutions, sometimes they're just shot down. It's my way or the highway with a lot of these people.
Do you find that
turns into a problem, you know?
Yeah. Do you find you're being shot down now when you try to have a reasonable conversation?
I think nationally as a country, we find that now. We find that, you know, more and more there's less sense of people taking a balanced view and being prepared. While everyone is entitled to having their point of view and strongly held and all that, they're also entitled to have it challenged and to have it discussed and debated and worked out and come to a reasonable solution that everyone can live with. And that's what we need to do in all these circumstances, wherever they may be.
Martin Kenny TD with Mary Wilson on Drive Time. You know that it's a truism in broadcasting that just because someone is good at something, they're not necessarily good at talking about it. We've all sat through excruciating interviews with musicians, actors or sports people who may be the best at what they do, but can't put two words together on radio. It's as if they've put so much energy into the achievement, there's none left for the chat. The exception to that rule is Oisin Murphy. He's a 24-year-old jockey from Killarney and he's just been named British flat racing champion. And not only that, he has an ease and an articulacy about him. He spoke to Des Cahill on Saturday Sport.
So my uncle Jim Cullity was a good jump jockey and then obviously he started training and when I was about 15, he asked me to come and ride out one morning. So I'd never ridden a racehorse before, and it's completely different to riding a normal horse. And I got a run off with on the gallop. I was probably supposed to do two laps of this half-mile gallop, and I ended up doing about 10, completely out of control. You can imagine the adrenaline rush. Possibly not too much fear, because I wasn't scared of horses, but I couldn't slow down. So I kind of knew there and then that I'd like to be a jockey.
Oisin now works in Britain, and he told Des about his week.
So I live in Lambourne, which is about an hour west of Heathrow, and I have a full-time driver, so I'd never have to drive to the races myself. I don't normally ride out on Mondays, so I try and stay in bed until, you know, 8:30 or 9 o'clock on a Monday. And then I would go racing. I suppose Windsor in the evening would be the common one. So that's only an hour away. That's my Monday done and dusted. Tuesday I would have to ride out, normally about 30 minutes to Andrew's Yard. Ride, gallop two horses. That would take the bones of an hour and a half or 2 hours. And then Nottingham would say on a Tuesday, which would be 2.5 hour journey, and then maybe in the evening at Kempton or something. So without boring anybody, that's kind of a typical, easy, normal few days. And then on a Friday, I might have to fly to York. Normally I would take a small plane because that's less expensive than a helicopter. So would say an hour's plane journey with landing fees on a grass strip might only be 1,200 or 1,600 quid. Whereas if I took a helicopter, be normally 3 or 4 grand. So, and obviously I have to pay for all this myself unless I'm riding for like my boss, Qatar Racing, Sheikh Fahd.
And with your driver, do you sit in the front seat or do you sit in the back and snooze?
It depends on my mood. Her name's Sue. She's driven me for 3 or 4 years and she's the one who has to deal with the good and the bad days.
Your moods.
Yeah. It's really embarrassing to admit, but you know, we could go 3 hours and I wouldn't speak a word. So, and then you have the elation of when things are going well.
Oisin Murphy, champion jockey with Des Cahill on Saturday Sport. If you want to listen back to that interview on the RTE radio player, it's at about 4:30. He's a great talker. Earlier in the day on The Business, Richard Curran had two people on talking about, well, talking, specifically accents. A study has just been published stating another truism, I would have thought, that your accent can work against you in the workplace. Richard's guests were actor Emmett Kerwin and linguistics expert Elaine Vaughan from the University of Limerick.
The research consistently shows that when you get people to listen to accents, they will associate values with those accents. And where it becomes more sinister then, when you look at this Yale study, here's where it really, really starts to count. It counts in ways that hold people back. So somebody is not going to get another interview because they don't sound the right way. And they showed actually in that study that all it took was 7 words for people to make up their minds.
And that's it and it's over. Yeah. Emmett, what about you in terms of your own accent? Have you ever felt that it held you back? Have you ever felt judged, discriminated against, anything like that?
I don't know about judged or discriminated. I suppose I'm very aware of my accent because I live in situations like this where I'm in studios and I have headphones on my head so I can hear myself continually. But I'm asked to modulate my accent. I'm asked to change my accent continually as an actor. So what happens is, you know, for certain brands, I'll be asked to Dublin it up a little bit. And then in other brands, I'll be asked to kind of make it middle class, but it's never overt. Nobody ever says, can you make that middle class? Can you make that working class? Often there's kind of those codified language of...
Like what?
Could you make it more Dublin? You know, or, you know, doing a soccer ad, they'd be like, ah, maybe it could be a bit more. And I'll kind of tease them a bit, go, working class? No, we didn't say that, you know what I mean? So it's kind of funny for me because I'm very aware of it, you know what I mean? You can see the people through the glass and they're trying to scramble for the right way to ask the question. So yeah, for rugby, it's one accent when I'm advertising something for the rugby, you know, Guinness or something like that. And then for the soccer, it's another accent that's closer to my own accent.
Elaine, mm-hmm. Have you ever been in a situation where you felt having your accent was going against you in any way?
I have. Many years ago, and in a way still, I worked in English language teaching. So I've worked in various different places. I've worked in Ireland as well. So I was working abroad, and well, just as Emmett says there, you know, sometimes in the workplace, it's not necessarily about you not getting the job, but it's about how people comment on the way that you speak. So, for example, as a speaker of Irish English, I was in plenty of situations where people would laugh at the way that I spoke English. You know,
they would laugh.
They'd make a joke of it. Or they'd say, you know, the way in Ireland you don't pronounce your THs, like every single person in Ireland doesn't pronounce a TH. Or I would say something like, I'm after doing something. And they, you know, that would be a cause of humour, which is OK. You know, at the time, it wasn't OK for me because I was young.
How did you react at the time?
Well, at the time, you know, I was young, so I said nothing. What I should have said was, actually, I'm speaker of Irish English. This is normal in Irish English, and this is how we express X or Y thing. In that way, it worked against me to sound Irish, but in other ways, it worked for me. So I worked somewhere else where I was chosen as the person who would make announcements over a speaker because I didn't sound too posh, but I was also intelligible.
What happens a lot of the time is the ludicrous kind of situation where one Irish person is saying to another Irish person, speak correctly, when actually, you know, nobody does really speak phonetically correctly. Conor McGregor has that weird kind of like thing where he pronounces, overpronounces things, and some people do that. And it sounds strange when people speak, you know, it doesn't sound right to the ear. And I think it's the same in Dublin. I was teaching somebody an accent, and let's say like the word matter, for example, M-A-T-T-E, or Dubliner might say, that doesn't matter. So there's a glottal pop where the T gets removed completely. My own father might say, that doesn't matter, where he's turned the T's into a D. But I remember somebody, you know, who had a very South County Dublin accent correcting another actor saying, you know, you speak correctly. But he said matter. So the T's got turned into a T-H and S sound. It was air being pushed over. So the idea that anybody is speaking the language in this phonetically precise, correct way, and really what they're saying is, I want you to sound more like I do.
Emmett Kerwin and Dr. Elaine Vaughan with Richard Curran on The Business. One man who wasn't held back either by his accent or his background is Martin Linney from the Zoology Department in Trinity College Dublin. He spoke to Ella McSweeney about his working life, beginning with his passion for collecting animals as a child in Walkinstown, Dublin.
Rats, mice, gerbils, hamsters, all kinds of birds, anything I could collect in the wild, newts, frogs.
So all alive. All alive, yeah.
So I kept them in a kind of a menagerie. I built a shed in the back garden and kept all these animals.
How old were you?
Oh, about 12, 13 years old.
Then one day when Martin was 15, his dad saw an ad for a lab technician in Trinity's zoology department. He applied and got the job, but he didn't really know what he was letting himself in for.
University, first of all, wasn't an option. You know, I can't ever remember having discussion with my friends about university. You know, it really didn't come under a radar at all, you know. So for me, working in university, when most of my friends worked in trades, like carpentry, sheet metal working, or worked in offices, this was very unusual. And everybody was fascinated the idea that I was working in a university. They weren't surprised that it was the zoology department, obviously. But I suppose I didn't really think beyond that. And first impressions weren't great because you come in as a boy, essentially, and you're not working with animals at all. You're working the labs, you're cleaning glassware, and you're topping up solutions and that. So I was sort of, when am I going to start working with animals? When is this going to happen? So that took a while, but once that happened, I really...
It's amazing how a passion can drive you, isn't it?
Yeah,
you
know, absolutely.
And give you the 100%. Sort of the courage to be able to push your own career. Indeed. I mean, what is extraordinary for you is that not only did you go in and work, but you began to study up to a PhD in your area and what you believed in.
Yeah, well, the first thing they did was when I joined Trinity was they sent me off to College of Technology in Kevin Street I hadn't actually studied any science in my junior cert. It wasn't an option in the school I was in. So I started in Kevin Street that same year at just turning 16 and remained there for 7 years doing various examinations. So it was essentially a degree in science, which pretty much was all science and experiments. I loved it. I really loved it. It was essentially a full-time course, really, because we were doing about 20 hours a week study there, you know. So
in between working?
Yeah, in between working. So you were on day release and you worked on Saturdays and you worked in the evenings. So that just increased my, I suppose, my interest in science in general. And then later, I worked in the Natural History Museum in London and in Glasgow, and I thought about the idea of doing a PhD.
Which he got. from a garden shed to becoming a doctor. Martin Linney with Ella McSweeney. Another doctor-to-be who overcame potential barriers is Alex Adams. She's a medical student and she's visually and hearing impaired. She spoke to Jennifer Zamparelli.
Who's been more sceptical about your ability, patients or medical staff?
Oh, definitely medical staff.
Isn't that crazy?
If anything, it's really surprising when people ask me this question. I say, well, actually, the patients are they're the wonderful ones out of this. You know, they either kind of don't even question it and just let me get on, you know, as any other person would, or they would be curious. And actually, I like it when people are curious, because instead of sort of, you know, jumping to conclusions and assuming things, quite often the wrong stuff, they ask the questions. They go, oh, so how does this work? Or what can you see? And how do you go about this? And it's really lovely. It's sad that it's my senior colleagues that are the ones that kind of brush me aside. I can remember, you know, starting medical school, and I had a meeting quite early on, and the meeting was on the first floor. And I walked in and they said, oh, be careful of the corner of the tables. They're really, really sharp and we don't want you, you know, causing us any extra paperwork. So within a few seconds of seeing me for the first time with the white cane, they had made assumptions. So at the end of this meeting, I decided to, you know, make a statement and run down the stairs. And I got down into the corridor, which was quite, you know, dark. So I was feeling around for the door handle. And at the top of the stairs, they were just standing there and said, oh, you know, how do you expect to be a doctor if you can't find a door handle?
But she's persevered. Alex has an advantage, although it didn't probably seem like that at the time, and that is that she herself has spent a lot of time in hospital as a patient.
Being in the bed, I kind of realised what made a good doctor and what made a bad doctor, and I came across sort of many people that are able to show me that they had empathy. And actually, empathy is far more important in being a doctor than necessarily having vision and hearing. Patients not necessarily want to know their blood test results or their CT scans. They just want someone to sit down for those few extra minutes to say, look, I know what you're going through, or this will be okay. It's going to get better. And I realized that again when I was a patient for a year and a half. And actually, I've had, since starting medical school, I've had 15 admissions to intensive care. So I know what it's like to feel, or to be incredibly sick and to kind of go between life and death, if you like. But when I was in for that very long period, I just remember a bunch of doctors coming around the bed each day and just kind of muttering through the notes and then moving on. And not once did they address me and say, you know, this is what's happening. And so I was scared. I had no idea what was happening. And there was this one junior doctor that came back and said the three most important words a patient wants to hear. And they were, are you okay? And of course, that was the first time I'd been asked this question. And I burst into tears and I said, no, I'm really not. And so she got up and she closed the curtains around the bed and she lifted up her blouse and she showed me a huge scar that went along her ribs. And she just said, I know how you feel. And she had been in hospital at a similar time for me and a similar age. And so she knew what I was going through. And she taught me that actually empathy is far more important than anything else, beyond the textbooks, beyond the exams, beyond the blood test.
Alex Adams with Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM. Brexit, never far from our thoughts, popped up in the most unlikely place this week on RTE Gold, RTE's classic hit station. Given that Brexit is now one of the world's longest breakups, RTE Gold's DJs decided to play a day of breakup songs. Not only that, they did a countdown of the top 100 breakup songs. And what was number one? Rick O'Shea was the DJ for the final song.
The number of people I talked to in advance of this who said, it's going to be Sinead O'Connor, isn't it? Sinead O'Connor is going to be number one. Number two, the number one in our countdown is the Righteous Brothers.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. There's no tenderness like grief in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it, but baby, baby, I know it. You lost that love and feeling. Oh, that love and feeling.
The Righteous Brothers from RTE Gold's Top 100 Breakup Songs on Bank Holiday Monday. Over on Arena on RTE Radio 1 on the same day, they had a music special too, and this was to celebrate the work of Bruce Springsteen. Two of those in studio were journalists and fans, Lise Hand and David McCullough. Both told contrasting Bruce Springsteen stories. Lise's was about the time she was standing waiting on a street in Dublin and she felt a hand on her behind.
And I swing around in a rage, found myself staring slightly down, in fairness, into the eyes of Bruce Springsteen. So he stood and looked at me and I stood and looked at him, and there was this sort of like, what? And then he just muttered something and he just scuttled off. So I was fairly rock and roll at the time. So I was kind of going, all right, OK, I just got, felt up by Bruce Springsteen. That's, all in a day's work. So later on that evening, I went to the gig. And I was there. I was actually on a date with somebody I'd been seeing for a little while who broke up with me halfway through the gig, actually. And born to absolutely leg it, I think, by the speed he went out the door. But anyway, Bruce was introducing the band on stage, and he'd actually changed the format of who stood where for this particular show. And he goes, "And Paddy Scialfa." And at this stage, he was still, kind of technically sort of married. And Patty's sachet's on, and I went, oh my God. We had the exact same jeans, the exact same, and here's the shameful bit, suede fringe leather jacket, or a suede fringe jacket, and the exact same red blonde curly hair. So, draw your own conclusions. Yeah. I didn't wash those pair of jeans over, by the way, I tell you.
Lise Hand with Sean Rocks. Then David McCullough told Sean about his connection to a particular Springsteen song.
Our daughter was born Halloween 19 years ago, and my wife was quite ill afterwards, so she was still in the hospital. And I was driving in and out of the hospital with this tiny little being on the car seat beside me. And Live in New York had just come out, and Land of Hope and Dreams was one of the songs. And there's a line in it, "Dreams will not be thwarted, faith will be rewarded." And that was a message I needed to hear at the time, so I'll be forever grateful.
Hell, I will provide for you, and I'll stand by your side. You'll need a good companion now, oh, for this part of the ride. Yeah, leave behind your sorrows, let this day be the last. Well, tomorrow there'll be sunshine and sunshine, and all this darkness pass. Well, big wheels roll through fields where sunlight streams. Oh, meet me in a land of hope and dreams. Well, this train carries saints and sinners. This train carries losers and winners. This train carries whores and gamblers. This train carries lost souls. I said this train carries broken-hearted. This train thieves and sweet souls departed. This train carries fools and kings, Lord. This train all aboard. I said now this train dreams will not be thwarted. This train faith will be rewarded. This train, hear the steel wheels singing. This train, bells of freedom ringing. Well, big wheels roll through fields where sunlight streams.
Land of Hope and Dreams from the Arena special on Bruce Springsteen featuring Lise Hand and David McCullough. That was on Bank Holiday Monday. Earlier that day, poor Brian Dobson had an awkward moment when he spoke with one of the oldest competitors in the Dublin City Marathon, Frank Behan. Frank is 78 and has run in all 40 Dublin City Marathons. Now, when you talk to someone after a marathon, they're either going to be still on a high and yak away, or they're recovering and are going to be less effusive.
Very good morning to you, Frank. How are you feeling this morning?
I'm feeling a bit sore on the legs, am I poor? Like, muscle pain as usual after over that distance.
Frank Behan with Brian Dobson on Morning Ireland. Justin McCarthy on This Week had better luck with marathon runners, but that may have been because he employed a very unusual interview technique.
Running in Ballymun on a Thursday morning.
When you go into a direct provision centre and you say, come on, do you want to go running? People often say, oh my God, it's the last thing I want to do, you know?
Justin was reporting on the sanctuary runners. They use running to help those living in direct provision to meet the wider Irish community.
I'm Sakene Ngomo. I'm from Zimbabwe.
And do you have friends and family here?
Yeah, I'm having friends now. The sanctuary runners, they are my friends.
What has it been like to integrate, to get to know Irish people? Have you found it difficult to get to know Irish people?
No, they are so friendly and lovely. They are good people.
For Sakene, running has helped her. She's made friends and improved her mental and physical health.
Oh, it was difficult for me. It was not easy. I couldn't even lift my leg to run. Now I'm okay. And I think they helped me because I was not mentally stable because of what was happening in my country. I can say I'm better now.
The Sanctuary Runners from This Week on Sunday. This is the RTE Concert Orchestra and the programme Strings Attached. Country music with orchestral arrangements. This is Ray Lynham.
Mona Lisa lost her smile. The painter's hands are trembling now. And as she's out there running wild, it's just because I taught her how. The masterpiece that we had planned is laid shattered on the ground. Lisa lost her smile, and the painter's hands are trembling now. And the eyes that used to burn for me, they no longer look my way. And the love that used to be, why, it just got lost yesterday. She seems cold to the touch, where they used to burn flame. I gave too little, took too much, so I erased.
Mona Lisa lost her smile. Ray Lynham with the RTE Concert Orchestra on the Strings Attached programme on Bank Holiday Monday. Earlier in the day, Colm O'Regan wanted a word about climate breakdown and our response to it. His guest was climate activist Richard Curtin.
We can make the changes within the current model, so it would have to be some sort of a system change. And this can be done in an equitable and just way, so we have some sort of a kind of a planned degrowth. So what we would...
So that word is degrowth?
Degrowth,
yes. New word,
yeah. Yes, so it would be basically you'd look at like the global north, the developed countries, they would slow down their growth economics, and then you look at the global south, they would be allowed to develop. And with that as well, you'd bring in the more kind of concepts of kind of enoughism, as you were saying. You'd have your one pair of jeans and you'd be happy out with that.
Colm reckons that cutting down on consumption should be easy for anyone who has had an Irish mammy.
Mammy, I'm cold.
Put on a jumper if you're cold.
The jumper. Remember the jumper? Better than any app-controlled thermostat in the cloud or any Internet of Things BS. The jumper. I mean, we celebrated at Christmas, ironically now, by wearing jumpers with designs that we wouldn't dare have worn for our mothers. But jumpers are heroes. How a jumper works, for anybody who's not familiar, a jumper works as follows, right? If you feel cold, you put it on, right? And then if your internal thermostat, known as your blood, feels a little too hot, then you take the jumper off. It's really, really easy. I think it could really take off. And it's something that I'm hoping to develop with some venture capital.
Bye, Mammy.
Where are you off to?
Out.
Out where?
Just out.
Haven't you enough gallivanting now for 1 week?
Years ahead of their time, Irish mammies realised that endless pursuit of enjoyment and fulfilment actually only leads to a certain sense of emptiness. Fun isn't endless, it's finite. It needs to be rationed. Stay in, read a book and save the planet.
Although if the planet continues to warm up, Colm reckons it could change one thing about Ireland, our literature.
A lot of our books were written in the rain, and it dominates a lot of the themes.
The rain beat down outside, and where it wasn't raining, the mist cloaked the hills. And where it wasn't raining, Flanagan looked at his father, who he hadn't spoken to because of what happened in the rain. But also the rain.
Bastards!
His father spat it into the fire. More rain. Flanagan sipped his cup of soup and smiled bitterly. Outside it was raining. Did I mention the rain?
Whereas from now on...
It was another one of those long Mullingar days. Esmeralda stretched and yawned and unwound her evenly tanned legs. Outside, the jacaranda tree creaked in the heat. She sipped her mint julep. Someone was having a barbecue outside, which they had planned far in advance. With very little worry, a Tullamore alligator swam up from Tullamore.
Tara Flynn with Paul Tylak from Colm O'Regan Wants a Word on RTE Radio 1. This is from the All-Ireland Fly and Drogheda, as heard on Cayley House on Saturday night. Taobh na Mara Cayley Band, based in Dungarvan, from Cayley House on Saturday night. By chance, the following morning, John Bowman played a piece from Cayley House from the archives. He wanted to make a point about social history and how little clues are often found in innocuous chat. John's programme featured Kathleen Watkins, and there was a clip of her playing harp and singing. Kathleen Watkins also happened to be one half of a celebrity couple, the other half being the broadcaster Gay Byrne.
First of all, Sean O'Murricu, introducing Cayley House, had this to say.
Anyway, Kay Watkins is here. Kathleen Watkins is the wife of you-know-who. It's not me, alas, Lucky Kay. Kathleen Watkins sings The Mucky Kid.
This is just a fragment. Note how the song ends and the back announcement by Sean O'Murricu. The social history is in the fees and in the house prices.
You're growing up a real hard case. There's not a one that can take your place. So go to sleep for Mammy.
The 15 guineas a song here made any difference to our Kathleen living in a £15,000 house out there in Howth with guess who?
Whatever about the price of the house at the time, it was really odd the way he talked about it, wasn't it? That was from John Bowman's programme on Sunday morning. And curiously, just a few minutes later, there was another bit of social history in It Says in the Papers that will definitely intrigue audio archaeologists of the future.
Ireland's spectacular wealth was the reason Irish rugby fans were able to drown out the haka during last weekend's Rugby World Cup clash with the All Blacks. That's the view of IBEX Head of Corporate Affairs, Siobhan Masterson, anyway. She's quoted in Aidan Corkery's article in the Business Post, suggesting there is reluctance to acknowledge the country's spectacular wealth, as she describes it, because we have been imprisoned in a kind of austerity mindset. Miss Masterson points to the type of Irish supporter who travelled to Japan to support the rugby team. When you look at the profile of those passengers, it's not business travel, it's leisure, she says. adding their Irish people taking third, fourth and fifth holidays every year.
There's a thesis in that. An austerity mindset that doesn't acknowledge our spectacular wealth. An observation prompted by a chant at a football game. Angus Cox from It Says in the Papers and RT Radio 1. Tuesday must have been a dreadful day for Christine Ryan. She spoke to Sean O'Rourke from Frankfurt. She was on her way home with the body of her son, Michal, who had died in the crash of the Ethiopian Airlines Boeing 737 MAX airplane in March last.
Well, I'd say we all have a sense of relief that remains have been found and that we can bring him home. My two daughters have had babies recently. One of them has a 2-week-old baby and the other one has a 12-week-old baby. So they couldn't come out with me, but we'll be meeting up in Clare for the burial, the graveyard. So finding everybody is finding it difficult, you know.
Yes, and it's wonderful that you have those two little new children in the family to, I suppose they will take a lot of your time and attention in the coming weeks and months and years. And that's great news. I suppose there's always going to be the sadness that Mick isn't going to be around to enjoy his nephews and nieces.
That is true.
Of course, there's the terrible sadness as well that his own two children, one I think a 4 or 5 year old, and then just a newborn when he died, they're going to grow up without their dad.
Oh yeah, there's a very big sadness and very big loss for them, you know. But that's unfortunately the way it is.
As you mentioned, Christine, he has been honoured by the United Nations and recognised for his achievements in saving lives and helping people in the most distressing and distressed situations. So how would you like him to be remembered into the future now?
As a very caring person who cared about humanity and was concerned for people and for the betterment of situations and tried to do his best to improve the marginalised.
Christine Ryan with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday, which coincidentally was also the day the head of Boeing, who make the 737 MAX aircraft, appeared before Congress in America to apologise. He said that the company's testing had fallen short, as had their safety assumptions. And if you're accepting that on face value, it's worth listening back to Philip Boucher-Hayes' step-by-step guide to the Boeing 737 MAX story, which he told on Drive Time that same day. He began by explaining that Boeing needed a new type of aircraft to keep up with Airbus. They could either come up with a whole new design or go with a cheaper option. Modify the old aircraft by leaving the design relatively unchanged, but putting bigger engines on.
The 737 wasn't high enough off the ground for the new larger engine, so it had to be incorporated into the wing. This changed the lift of the wings on takeoff and had the effect of pushing the nose of the plane up.
In order to counteract that, they thought, well, OK, we can just put in a technological fix here. Nobody needs to know about it.
Philip spoke to aviation expert Simon Calder.
We will just put in this software. If the aircraft thinks, I'm getting quite close to a stall here, it will just put the nose down and the pilot possibly won't even know what's been going on. They will just avoid the risk of a stall.
In order to avoid pilots asking questions about this automatic pilot override known as MCAS, Boeing decided not to tell anyone about it, thereby saving the airlines the expense of retraining. Perhaps the single biggest contributory factor in the loss of 346 lives. When the nose inexplicably started pointing down, pilots had no understanding why it was happening.
Pilot was not aware to the MCAS system and they could not identify what happened on the flight since they did not recognize what happened to the aircraft.
Prioritising financial savings over safety has resulted in a huge loss of public and regulatory faith in Boeing. So today, its CEO, Dennis Muilenburg, went through the well-worn political theatre of a congressional hearing and public apology as part of the process of ritual atonement.
On behalf of myself and the Boeing Company, we are sorry, deeply and truly sorry.
The sincerity of that apology, completely undermined by the fact that in the aftermath of the crashes, Boeing blamed the pilots.
Boeing came to my office shortly after these crashes and said they were the result of pilot error. Those pilots never had a chance. These loved ones never had a chance. They were in flying coffins as a result of Boeing deciding that it was going to conceal MCAS from the pilots.
It's the closing lines of Phillips' report that are the most dispiriting.
Undoubtedly, Boeing 737s will take to the skies again in the next few months after tweaks to the MCAS software. There is simply too much money at stake for them not to.
Part to Philip Boucher-Hayes' report on the Boeing 737 MAX story from Drive Time on Radio 1. One of the images of the week has to be that from Colin Regan, writing about the coast of Leitrim.
Not a lot of people outside the northwest know of Leitrim's three-mile coastline. But for those who live in it, who from it hail, it has helped define who we are. Tullahan Village is where the county dips its toe into the waters of the Atlantic.
The short Leitrim coast has been significant in Colin's life, on one occasion in particular, 17 years ago.
Shortly after my brother Gordon died in a car crash in 2002, aged 30, our family headed together to Tullahan's coast, with our grief draped about our shoulders like seaweed on the rocks. We found the tide had bowed its head and humbly receded to expose Leitrim's little oasis of sand. And we sat on our private beach as the sun came out from behind Tent Lodge, and the family's next generation played and made sandcastles and little plans of their own. As we walked into the water together, three generations and a fourth soon to follow, I looked back on Tullahan, knowing that soon the waves would wash away the footprints of my parents and the castles of their grandchildren, and that nothing could turn back that tide. And so we celebrated a life well lived.
Colin Regan from Sunday Miscellany. That was a lovely line. Grief draped about their shoulders. Every day at about 20 to 1, Joe Duffy comes into Ronan Collins' programme to talk about what's coming up on Liveline later that afternoon. On Wednesday, Joe mentioned this.
Last Saturday morning on the Goree Arklow stroke motorway, about 15 minutes from Goree, a man, the listener, came across an overturned black van and he helped rescue the driver. He's very keen to find out how is the driver. If you were a driver of a black transit van that overturned on the Arklow and Goree bypass.
As I'm driving along, I see it looks like a black, it's just a black shape on the side of the road. Down amongst the grass, and as I drive closer, I see some lights, some tail lights, you know.
Wow, okay.
And I'm still baffled to myself, so that I'm wondering what this is, you know. No one's stopping, everyone keeps driving on, so I decide to slow down myself as I'm going past, and it turns out that it's a van that's been overturned, and I see a body in the window.
Wow.
Nobody seems to be stopping.
Okay.
So I stop the car myself, and just as I'm stopping, a big truck stops behind me as well, and another man jumps out. The two of us are sprinting over to this car, and we look in the windshield, and there's an old man, probably in his 60s or so, just leaning against the window.
All right.
And he's alive, but he's in the car, and, you know, we end up pulling him out, basically.
And how did you get him out? It's on its side, I presume.
Yeah, so it's on its side, exactly. So basically, he'd be standing on what would be the driver's side door,
mm-hmm.
and the passenger side door would be above his head. But because it's a van, it's probably 6 feet or so, he can't reach it, you know.
Of course,
so,
yeah.
Myself, the trucker, would jump up, climb up basically, or the underneath of the car, on top of this side of the car
mm-hmm.
that's pointed up in the air, and we lift up the door. And there he is, he's in there, he's bloodied, he's battered, bruised, shaken, but he's alive.
Yeah, wow. And have you heard about the man since?
I haven't heard anything.
No, I can tell. I can tell you his name.
Okay.
His name is Michael Connell.
Okay.
Yeah. What age are you saying Michael is, Niall? Be careful now. But you...
late 50s, I'm going to go with.
You said 60s earlier on, caller.
I have to retract that probably.
Okay, stay there, Niall. Michael Connell, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
What age are you, sir?
I am actually 62, but I'm quite put out that I've been described as an old man.
Well, say hello to your rescuer there, Niall Scully.
Thank you very much, Niall. I do remember you very, very well.
No problem
thank
at
you
all.
For yourself and the truck driver. I hit a wet patch on the road and the next thing.
Well, tell us what happened. Well, you were coming down, you were heading towards Wexford, were you?
I was heading towards the antique fair in Wexford. Oh, okay. And quite blink of an eye, the SOS pole was to my driver's side where it should have been to the passenger side. Okay. And I was in the ditch. And literally, you're talking 2-3 seconds.
And you don't remember you don't remember feeling the van going from under you or skidding or aquaplaning or...
No.
Has anything, like you sound so calm, has anything like that ever happened to you before?
No.
No.
Nothing.
Okay.
I've never had a serious car crash. I did have a liver transplant and I was 3 months in a coma.
Wow.
But apart from that, that's the most serious thing that's ever happened to me.
And you were 3 months in hospital?
Oh, I was a year in hospital.
Wow.
I was 3 months in what I would call a parallel universe. I've no memory of of anything. My friends would tell me, a good friend tells me, I rang him one night and demanded I come into the hospital that I had something important to tell him. And when he came in, I said to him, sit down there, we need to sort this out. I'm after winning the lotto and some birds come in and rob the ticket.
What?
And he said that to me about a year. He said,
yeah, do you remember
saying that to me? No memory at all.
Wow.
Michael Connell, and before that, Niall Scully, one of his rescuers. Does anyone use the term bird anymore? Obviously they do. That was from Liveline. On Tuesday morning, Ella McSweeney came across a story in the papers that caught her eye.
Filmmakers and directors are going mad because Netflix have a new test feature that allows viewers to watch their content at variable speed. So you can basically, it's like, you know, speaking with helium, you can do really high speed so you can look at something and get through, speed up the show really quickly. You can also slow it down. But there's a sense that impatient fans will love this. But directors are going crazy and saying, this is a terrible idea, said Ant-Man director Peyton Reed, and every director I know will fight against it. And Knocked Up director Apatow said, don't make me have to call every director and show creator on earth to fight you on this.
Ella McSweeney on Tuesday morning. And how would that work with music? Well, later that morning over in Lyric FM, you had a chance to imagine it because Niall Carroll played what must have been the most frantic piece of music played on RTE Radio this week, Paganini's Moto Perpetuo. This is it if you slowed it down a la Netflix. And this is Paganini at normal speed. Isn't that exhausting? Moto Perpetuo by Paganini and the man burning up the fiddle was Salvatore Accardo from Niall Carroll's Classical Daytime and Lyric FM. And more classical music, this time from the Marion Finucane programme. Her guest was soprano Claudia Boyle.
I would be called a lyric coloratura. So coloratura refers to all these really fast scales and vocal acrobatics and everything like that. And also you can sing really, really high, what we like to call the money notes, you know. So it's great.
Why are they called the money
well,
notes?
People like a high note, Marion. You know, they do. They really do. Audiences love it. So one of the most famous arias for a lyric coloratura is the very famous Queen of the Night aria, Der Hulle Racha. And here, the Queen of the Night wants her daughter, Pamina, to kill her husband Sarastro, and she says if she doesn't kill her husband she will disown her as a daughter for life.
Extreme enough.
Yes.
Thank you.
by gum, there's some acrobatics of or what?
Yeah, completely. And I think everybody knows that piece of music. You know, they've heard it somewhere. It's just so famous.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's so exciting just like to hear a voice singing in that way. These really, really high notes. It was so precise and the vocal acrobatics. It's so dramatic.
In the women's range.
Yes.
There's soprano.
There's a soprano. So then moving down. So it moves down really in vocal range. So then what we have is a mezzo soprano, which basically means kind of half a soprano. Now, they're not half a soprano. I mean, that sounds very insulting. Mezzos are wonderful singers, you know.
Yeah.
But they have a creamier texture to their voice, a darker colour. And they don't sing quite as high as sopranos. So, you know, a very famous character is, let's say, Carmen. And she was, you know, that's sung by a mezzo. And actually, mezzos tend not to do such leading roles. Like, there's very few of them compared to sopranos, let's say.
Yeah.
But they're still, nonetheless, I mean, when you hear a mezzo singing really, really deep, rich colours, it's absolutely beautiful. Now, a great example, actually, of a soprano and a mezzo soprano singing together is the wonderful duet from Lakme by Delib. Now, this actually was used in the British Airways advert. And British Airways were very, very clever here because this is a beautiful piece of music. It's very serene. Here, Lakme and Malik, they're getting ready to have a bath and they're singing about all the flowers in the garden and the roses. And British Airways was very clever here because they really want to evoke calmness in their travellers.
Right,
calmness,
yeah.
Security and above all, quality.
Have a listen to this.
Soprano Claudia Boyle with Marion Finucane. John Creedon, of course, specialises in music, and on his show, he's usually the one reading out the requests, but not the other night.
I got a message there a little earlier from, just a little while ago, a few minutes ago actually, from Emer Kelly, saying that our son is just 8 years of age, but a regular listener to the programme. He's heading off to bed shortly, but he loves Tom Petty. Is there any chance you play some Tom Petty for him? I just thought to myself, what a brilliant idea. And then I realised that it came with a video attached of Logan asking for the request. So I just checked there with Mom and she said, cool, let him ask for it himself. So this is Logan with his request. Here we go.
Because that's my bedtime.
It's his bedtime. Shh. Here he is.
Hello, John. My name is Logan and I'm 8. I was wondering if you could play Running Down a Dream by Tom Petty before 9 o'clock, because that's my bedtime.
You got it, Logan.
Tom Petty, as requested by Logan on John Creedon's show. And two women who know all about bedtimes were on with Miriam McCallaghan, comedians Sinead Culbert and Sue Collins. They've written a book just for modern mothers on how to avoid letting it all get to you.
That kind of insta-perfect life we're supposed to be leading, you know what I mean? We're supposed to have like everything, the perfect house, marriage, kids, you know, with the BMI of Elle Macpherson, you know what I mean? So it's which is not possible.
And the arse of Jennifer Lopez.
Yes.
Which we both have, but you know, you can't see it on radio.
You don't like boasting about it.
No. We don't like going on about that, no.
And I think you dedicated the book, that's right, to the women of Ireland who are hanging by a thread.
Hanging by a thread.
Yourself.
Yeah.
Well,
exactly.
I think it's just the day-to-day struggles. You know what I mean? It's just that kind of the stuff that you need a lot of deep breathing for.
Yeah.
I think in the book there's, you know, there's chapters like mindfulness is definitely better than manslaughter.
Yeah. It's just all the struggles and stresses that women have. You know, so we've chapters like learn how to love your muffin top. That's another one, because
embrace it.
Embrace it, because it's such a struggle for women. You spend months and months trying to lose weight. You lose about 5 pounds and then you go out for one night, have a McDonald's on the way home and put on 2 stone. It's cruel.
Sinead Colbert and Sue Collins with Miriam O'Callaghan on Sunday. Sport provided a range of emotional stories this week. For example, Kilkenny hurler Owen Larkin was in with Sean O'Rourke talking to him about wrestling with depression and when he managed to get help for it.
I was after having a poor day in the Leinster final and I was withdrawn at half time and, you know, went out for a few drinks and then, you know, for the full week nearly I was in bed, you know, I just didn't want to see anybody, didn't want to talk to anybody and went to a club match on the Friday night. Was just there in body, not in mind, and Brian would have seen this and I got a phone call on the Saturday morning after the game, looked at the phone, Brian Cody's name on it, wondered, knew what was coming, but wondered would I answer. Eventually answered, and, you know, a simple question of how are you feeling today, and I just burst into the floods of tears. And look, when you burst into floods of tears with Brian Cody on the other end of the line, you know, there's something definitely wrong. And, you know, in fairness to Brian, he would have said, look, he said, I'm here for you if you need to talk. Otherwise, he said, if you want to keep it between yourself and Ty Crowley, who was a doctor at the time at Wicklow-Kenny, just go in and see him, he said, and have a chat with him. So, but look, once I went to Tyg and, you know, I spoke about it, and like I've said, that Tyg made this sound like he was dealing with a sore throat. You know, it was that kind of a conversation. It was so normal to him. And that made me feel at ease. Now, and on most of the talking while I was in with Tyg, and Tyg asked me a few questions and I answered them. But, you know, once I had it out there, it was like someone just took their foot off my shoulders and I could breathe again.
Former Kilkenny hurler Owen Larkin with Sean O'Rourke. For Sunday Sport, Barry Lenehan did a GAA report that opened like this.
Come on, Berlin. Not something you'd expect to hear at a GAA venue. But
the Berlin GAA team don't have a ground. They play on an old airfield.
Former airport temple off there in the centre of Berlin closed down about 10 years ago and has been converted into a massive public park, as you can imagine. So that's where we train. It's pretty dreadful surface. There's an old soccer pitch on Tempelhof, not a very good one, but we stick Wavin piping with masking tape onto the goalposts. That's generally what we have to do, yeah.
Berlin were in Dublin for a game and some of the team had never been to Ireland. Although some had.
Berlin brought 30 players to Abbottstown, 14 counties represented. Former Kerry player Pat Joy, former Dublin minor Conor O'Brien, a goalkeeper from Yorkshire, a Belgian, four Aussies, an American. But for injury, there would have been an Israeli former semi-pro tennis player. Yet there was a Czech-Canadian, cornerback Jan-Marc Hanzo Liskowski.
I happened to be jogging in a field in Berlin and I saw some people playing and they invited me to join and I joined right away. And since then, that was about 2 years ago, and I play hurling and also Ga.
Isn't that the name of the week? Jan-Marc Hanzo Liskowski from Barry Lenehan's report as heard on Sunday Sport. And just before I go, one more little bit of sport from behind the scenes. On 2FM sport programme Game On, former rugby international Donal O'Callaghan was talking to his fellow presenter Marie Crow about the upcoming game featuring the Barbarians, or Babas as they're known.
I played for the Babas against England in Twickenham in 2014 and then again against Tonga in Limerick in Thomond, and that was a special one. It was my last time playing in Thomond and I was able to play with James Cronin and Brian Scott, young players that I'd seen come through the Munster Academy, so just made it a really special moment. And look, I think it's a nice way for Rory to go out as well. I think he'll lead the charge early in the week and hopefully he can do it in the pitch. Coached by Eddie Jones, and what you want to see with the Babas is forget game plans, structures. Like, all we did all week was play five-a-side soccer.
Because did you train? Like, did you practice lineouts?
All we practiced were, like, trick moves, silly moves. Like, if we had a lineout here, could someone throw the ball really far and try to hit the winger? Or, like, could our tight head prop make a cross-field kick? And everyone was really serious about that. But our first training session involved two cooler boxes of beers. And I'll be completely honest, I was the poorest Baba to play against England. I was really surprised I got asked to go back. I was the only sober one and I played brutal. So they were like, sober Babas don't really do it.
Donal O'Callaghan and Marie Crow from 2FM's Game On. And that's it for this week. I'm Ronan Kelly. Until next time, Slán.